This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and we're recording this at 4 o'clock GMT on Thursday, the 23rd of July. The US signs a nuclear deal with Saudi Arabia despite fears it could allow the Gulf Kingdom to develop a nuclear bomb. Israel has condemned the agreement. We have a special report on the growing protests against the education system in India by the so-called Cockroach Party. And Venezuela's ousted leader Nicolas Maduro has appeared in court in New York. What's the view in Caracas? Also in this podcast...
From the data, the one that surprised me the most is AI and sign language. It's really, really mind-blowing and very interesting.
The young Nigerians using AI to learn different languages. And the film version of The Odyssey helps boost sales of the book. President Trump says his war in the Middle East is aimed at stopping Iran getting a nuclear weapon. However, the US has now signed a pact with Iran's rival Saudi Arabia, which could allow it to develop a nuclear bomb and possibly trigger an arms race. The agreement is supposed to establish a civilian nuclear program in the Gulf Kingdom, but critics say lax safeguards mean the Saudis could be able to enrich uranium and reprocess nuclear waste and thus gain the ability to make a bomb. America's ally Israel has condemned the deal. Here's former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett.
The nuclear agreement taking shape with Saudi Arabia over Israel's head is a severe strategic failure that endangers our security. Enrichment of nuclear material on Saudi soil could lead to a regional nuclear arms race and a dangerous loss of control. There is truly no way to predict what the Middle East will look like in a decade or two. Which is why what we need is fewer centrifuges in the Middle East, not more.
The Trump administration insists the agreement will not lead to proliferation. Both Iran and Saudi Arabia have long insisted they have the right to pursue a civilian nuclear program and have no intention of developing a bomb. Saudi Arabia has said it would turn to China or Russia if it didn't get help from the US. Rina Shah is a former senior congressional adviser for the Republicans.
Is smart strategic leadership. American companies leading Saudi's civilian program means U.S. jobs, exports, and real influence, not ceding the field to China or Russia. We all want ironclad non-proliferation. I think this deal really delivers bilateral controls with American oversight and IAEA involvement on enrichment. These are practical protections that keep us in the driver's seat.
But Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna, who serves on the House Armed Services Committee, says he has deep concerns over the deal.
Saudi has not committed to giving up nuclear fuel production. In fact, they claim they have the right to do that, and they haven't agreed to inspection. So it is a terrible deal. But Trump is floundering in the Middle East. The Strait of Hormuz is closed. We're losing service members. Gas prices are up. The Saudis were upset at us because of this ill-planned war. And you see an administration flailing and making poor decisions.
The agreement will still have to be reviewed by the US Congress, but opponents are unlikely to have enough votes to block it. Our chief North America correspondent Gary O'Donoghue told us about the two parts of the deal, the Peaceful Nuclear Cooperation Agreement and the Bilateral Safeguards Agreement.
The first one is, we're understanding, a 30-year deal for the Americans to build civilian nuclear power plants in Saudi Arabia, tens of billions of dollars in potential revenues. And alongside it, we're told there'll be a bilateral safeguards agreement. Now, that is crucial because some of the commentary around this has been that Saudi Arabia would be not quite as under scrutiny as other deals have been in the past, particularly allowing it potentially to enrich its own uranium, which the US doesn't normally do when it does these deals, and also to have a slightly looser inspection regime. The bilateral word suggests to me that that's a safeguards arrangement between the US and Saudi Arabia, maybe not involving the International Atomic Energy Agency, which was usual in the past, but we'll have to wait and see the actual text to know if that's true. I mean, the deal has been in the pipeline for some time. The Biden administration wanted to do this deal. They tied it specifically, though, to Israel and Saudi Arabia normalizing relations. That fell apart after the attacks on Israel by Hamas. That linkage appears to have been dropped from this deal. The key thing, though, here, and the Americans are open about this, is that Russia and China were sniffing around this arrangement, trying to get in on this big time. In fact, Russia had signed a couple of preliminary agreements with Saudi Arabia on this. So the Americans were fearing that they would get frozen out. And that may be a potential reason, if it transpires to be the case, that there may be laxer controls, particularly on proliferation issues. But a big geopolitical win in that region. They don't want to lose their relationship with Saudi Arabia. They don't want to lose their leverage. And this is a big way of tying that in for several decades to come. So this will be regarded as a huge commercial success, obviously, but something of a coup for the State Department as well.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. In a landmark trial in California earlier this year, social media platforms were found liable for harmful effects on young users. A woman who sued Meta and Google won $6 million in damages. But now a second lawsuit against Meta, among thousands in the pipeline, has been dropped. A Florida teenager who'd sued four social media companies over his depression and anxiety decided not to go to trial with Meta after settling with YouTube, Snapchat and TikTok. I heard more from our technology reporter Callie Hayes in San Francisco.
The young man, who's only 15 years old, his lawyers described the potential stress that trial would cause for him as being part of the reason that he decided to drop this case. But he also felt that the attention that the cases have received thus far, of which he is one of many, has kind of served a purpose.
Will this, though, be seen as a victory for Meta? And what about the other platforms who already settled?
I think Meta, yes, could view this as a victory. They are attempting to appeal, along with YouTube, actually, the previous verdict that they received for damages in the initial trial. So there's a world in which I think they could use the fact that this young man decided to not go to trial to try to bolster their claims, that all of these claims by these young people are, you know, not sufficient. But the other companies, maybe they're kind of thinking right now that they wish they had stuck it out and hoped for a dismissal like this. It maybe would have saved them some money.
So Meta is avoiding a trial and a payout here, but there are many more cases which, what, will go to court?
Oh, yes. I mean, there are thousands, I think somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 to 4,000 cases right now working their way through, you know, various courts in California. And the way it's been working, this was similar in the LA proceeding where this young man just dropped his case today. But they're grouping hundreds of cases together and then picking specific ones, specific legal claims, to actually go to the trial stage. So there will be a handful more trials in the year to come, for sure. And they will have implications for many, many, many other cases making similar claims.
Callie Hayes in San Francisco. Days after a brutal police crackdown on the Cockroach Janata Party protests in Delhi, thousands of young people are braving heavy monsoon rains to take part in demonstrations in the Indian capital. At least 60 people were injured on Monday after police used batons and tear gas to try to disperse the crowds. Opposition politicians have thrown their weight behind the protests, disrupting proceedings in India's parliament to demand a debate on the crackdown. The youth-led Cockroach movement is demanding education reforms and the resignation of the education minister after a leak of a national entrance exam. Our South Asia correspondent Azadeh Mashiri sent us this report from Delhi.
I just got to the protest site and it's packed. I remember being here about a month ago at the very first one the Cockroach Janata Party had organised, and this is much bigger. It was just an internet meme before, and now there are thousands of people around me crammed into this one area. It's blocked off by riot vans and there are also multiple barricades.
We've been here for several days. We were here for the march. It was beautiful before the police came.
For those who don't understand how stressful the exam can be, could you explain why it was so upsetting?
Because even the smallest exam in India, because there's so much population, is like a lot of students against one seat. And when one exam goes right and you understand that that is not the one being counted, it's just brutal. It breaks your heart.
Most of the faces here look like they're about 25 years old or younger, but I can spot one woman who looks like she's a parent.
I feel as though all these children are my own. The police beat them brutally and they have severe injuries. I'm so deeply distressed by this that today I've come here bringing all my children and their friends along with me.
I keep seeing people wearing these masks of cockroaches and people passing out posters. So why the cockroach? There were these comments by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court about a month ago calling youngsters in social media and journalism cockroaches. He said his words were taken out of context, but Abhijit Dibke pounced on those comments. He's a student at Boston University, and he created social media accounts that in just days gained more followers than the ruling BJP party. Now, a month later, the chief spokesperson of the cockroach junta party, Sourav Das, told me this has become a movement that is impossible to ignore.
I think the cockroach junta party is a perfect example of the kind of rupture we are seeing in the society here in India. The social contract between the people who've been elected and the electors is completely broken because the government does not listen to the demands of the youth who are facing highest joblessness, unemployment levels, exam paper leaks, competitive exams are the only means for a lot of families to get out of poverty.
There are students I've spoken to. They say that for years they've felt ignored by mainstream politics. They're frustrated by high rates of unemployment, by lack of opportunities. I keep hearing that here. They may be calling for the education minister's resignation right now, but the students here, to them, this is just the beginning.
Azadeh Mashiri reporting from the Indian capital. This week in Lebanon, the army has begun deploying to a small number of villages in the war-torn south as part of a US-brokered deal. The agreement aims to see Israeli troops gradually replaced by Lebanese soldiers, who will then take on the task of disarming the militant group Hezbollah. There are three so-called pilot zones so far. Karine Torbay, correspondent for BBC Arabic, spent the day visiting them, or trying to visit them at least. She spoke to James Menendez from Beirut.
Well, the idea is basically to have some sort of a process that could lead to two things. First, the Lebanese army dismantling Hezbollah, the Shia militant group. And second, Israel withdrawing from Lebanon gradually until it actually leaves Lebanon altogether. But there are still many, many questions about how this will be done. Two of the three pilot zones that were assigned to the first trial aren't occupied, and the Lebanese army is already there. So it's created a lot of confusion about what is the role of the army and whether this will lead at all to the gradual withdrawal of all Israeli troops from Lebanon.
What about the third zone that you went to, Western Zorta? What was going on there?
Well, basically, we only could get to the one of the entry points to the town because the rest of the entrances are all too dangerous to go to. But we saw a lot of people gathering. These are the residents of Zorta, people who had to flee it in March following the last round of escalation between Hezbollah and Israel. And they haven't been back to their town since then. The Lebanese army only deployed yesterday into the town to make sure that it is cleared from any ammunition, from unexploded ordnance. So it's still very, very dangerous to go there. And while we were waiting, actually, we heard the sound of a nearby airstrike by Israel. It was hitting a town just close to where we were. We saw families, kids, women, men, all waiting to go back. Then there was a long queue of cars waiting, as well as ambulances, to get into the town to take any remains of the bodies that were trapped there for weeks following the attack and the battles that happened there. So we spoke to some of those people who were waiting to go back to their towns and to check on their properties.
I lost my paternal cousins and my maternal cousin. I lost my paternal uncle, a martyr in the previous war. We lost so much and so many people. Of course, we were hoping to go back to our land.
We don't know much, but from satellite images we received, it looks like our house is still standing. But we don't know whether it was damaged or burnt.
I'm waiting to be allowed into our homeland, to smell the scent of its soil, to get our souls back. We left during the ceasefire, after our house was destroyed. Zawata is our homeland, our soul and breath.
There are large parts of southern Lebanon that are completely under Israeli occupation, so people can't really get even close to there. Because there are two kinds of towns in Lebanon. Some of them by the border are occupied by Israel, but also there are large parts of the south that are under Israeli fire control. So also it is very dangerous to go there as someone could be hit at any moment. So although there is a theoretical ceasefire, Hezbollah has abided by it, but Israel says it retains its freedom of movement and every now and then continues to carry out strikes to detonate structures in areas it occupies.
BBC Arabic correspondent Karin Torbay talking to James Menendez. Still to come on the podcast...
It's really quite heartbreaking, to be honest. I was at one of the nurseries that UNICEF helps to run beside the treatment centre. There was a 9-year-old boy there. His mum died this morning.
A worrying spike in Ebola figures in the Democratic Republic of Congo. You're listening to the Global News Podcast. Since they were seized by US forces in January, Venezuela's former president Nicolas Maduro and his wife Celia Flores have been held in a jail in New York, facing drug trafficking charges. They're likely to remain there for some time after a judge set their trial date for June next year. Both deny the charges against them. Outside the court, protesters held placards calling Maduro and Flores dictators. But supporters of the former Venezuelan first couple said they should be released.
I'm out here today to demand the U.S. takes its hands off of Venezuela. The United States does not have the interests of the Venezuelan people in mind. All it wants is the oil. It wants the natural resources. That's all it's interested in.
Venezuelans should be able to dictate how they're governed. And our government should not have the right to go in other countries and kidnap, you know, elected leaders and bring them here for a sham trial.
I heard more from our correspondent Will Grant in the Venezuelan capital, Caracas.
As you were hearing there, certainly there was frustration and support outside the court that the two sides coming up against each other a little. But inside the courtroom, it was interesting. He came in a beige prison suit. His wife, Celia Flores, was there too. Now, he shook the hands of his legal team. The people in the gallery had been told very clearly not to address him, or, as the judge put it, they could face legal issues themselves. And that was largely respected, we understand. He listened intently as he was essentially told that the kickoff date for his trial will be the 1st of June. He wasn't shackled. And then when he left court, he sort of waved to the gallery briefly before being taken away by US marshals. And it was commentated here in Venezuela itself that apparently he looked like much thinner, which doesn't surprise you when you know that some of the conditions he's been kept in are pretty harsh.
Now, it is 6 months since he was seized by the Americans, and of course Venezuela itself still getting over those twin earthquakes. But do people there, are they focused on what's happening to him?
Things have moved on politically so quickly from Nicolas Maduro that it already feels a sort of distant moment. Of course, there are those who are fully committed revolutionaries in Venezuela who fully back Nicolas Maduro and feel that he has been illegally removed from power. But by and large, people in Venezuela, and certainly who I've spoken to in Caracas, have just moved on. It's almost like they haven't had a chance to breathe, given everything that's happened in this nation, both politically since the 3rd of January when Nicolas Maduro was removed from power, and of course with the twin earthquakes, the country's biggest natural disaster in 100 years.
Yeah, and how are people in the worst affected areas, how are they getting on with rebuilding their lives?
It is a very slow and painful process, and simply the act of finding their missing loved ones isn't over for so many thousands of families, Ollie. It is an extremely dark and difficult situation. The northern coastline in La Guaira state remains absolutely devastated. Of course, it's only been a month, so you wouldn't expect it to be anywhere near back on its feet. What we have seen is heavy machinery has sort of removed a lot of the rubble from some areas. Entire apartment blocks have been completely removed now, but of course that has created other tensions with the families who say in some cases their loved ones remain in there still. Now, there is international aid on the ground still, particularly in the form of the World Central Kitchen, which has given away a million meals by its estimations. There are teams working around the clock from every which way you can imagine, including the government. It needs to be said that they are working. It's just, I think, the criticism of them is certainly that initial response was very confused and chaotic. There's a lot of people who feel that they've never got the heavy machinery. They never really got a chance to dig for their loved ones while they might have still been alive.
Will Grant in the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. The Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo is now the third largest on record, with more than 1,000 people dead. The World Health Organization says many people are living in fear of being infected. John James is in Congo working for the UN's children's agency, UNICEF.
I've been here for about 2 months now. It's really quite heartbreaking, to be honest. I was at one of the nurseries that UNICEF helps to run beside the treatment centre. There was a 9-year-old boy there. His mum died this morning. On Saturday, I was in a different health zone in Nizi, about an hour away. We came out of meeting the doctor there, and a woman was just wailing. A clump of bows next to her, another baby that had died, and people sort of just a few metres away, putting on their protective clothing, getting ready to decontaminate the area.
There is currently no vaccine for the virus, though several are in development. Our global affairs reporter Richard Kagoye told us more about the spread of the disease.
The Ebola outbreak is spreading fast because we have about 1,000 cases right now. We have more than 2,000 confirmed cases. And we also have about 700 people who are currently either hospitalized or in isolation. That indicates that actually the virus is spreading fast, not just in the epicenter in the northeastern province of Ituri, but it has also been detected in four other provinces along the shared border with Central African Republic, South Sudan, and Uganda. We have about 189 children who have died since the outbreak was first detected in mid-May, and about 450 of them have contracted the disease during the period. And even for those who have survived, it's really caused an emotional toll on them. A lot of them are suffering from trauma. They're suffering also from fear because they have witnessed the loss, you know, that has been caused by this, and some of them being isolated, especially from their caregivers and even their parents as well. So this has really quite taken a toll on children who are also been dealing with issues to do with conflict, which is quite rampant in the areas which have been affected by the Ebola outbreak. What the government has done is really boost testing capacity, but still it's not enough. They have increased surveillance and are also increasing contact tracing, but there are numerous challenges that they are facing because especially camps which have been hosting people who have been displaced by conflict, they're really overcrowded. The sanitary conditions are not really good.
Richard Kagoye. According to a recent Google Search Trends report, there's been a sharp rise in young people in Nigeria using AI to teach themselves foreign languages and sign language. Many say the technology makes learning faster, cheaper and more personal. The trend comes as young professionals there continue to emigrate amid economic challenges and the high cost of living in Africa's most populous country. The BBC's Makwuchi Okafor spoke to two young Nigerians using AI to learn new languages.
Hey Google, how do I say I'm hungry in Thai?
This is Abigail Eyitayo, a travel and lifestyle content creator in Lagos, Nigeria. She uses AI to learn languages before and during her trips abroad.
I don't really use language learning apps, to be honest, because I can just have a one-on-one conversation with AI. I can say, pretend you're a friend and I'm learning how to speak this language for the very first time. How would we communicate? I'll start in French and you can continue that way.
In Thai, that's Chanhiu.
For Abigail, AI is not a classroom. It feels like a real conversation where she can practice, make mistakes and learn instantly.
For me, when AI came about, this is where I used it the most when I was in Thailand. When you want to eat something to know what the ingredient contains, I would snap the ingredient, just puts on AI, just list out. So it lists out everything as it is written there in the language you understand.
She says AI also helps her navigate daily life abroad, from reading food labels to understanding new environments. She's not alone. Samuel Aku is also using AI to stay connected with family abroad.
I would definitely want to go to Norway. And yeah, using AI has helped because now it's easier to speak with my cousins and the rest also. And sometimes they're like, oh, how are you learning fast, actually? And now I can type with it. and I'm really good at typing with it.
In recent years, many young professionals have left Nigeria in what is described as a brain drain as the economy continues to struggle with a high cost of living. Data from recent Google search trends in Nigeria show rising interest in languages such as German, Spanish, Italian, Japanese, and even sign language, with many young Nigerians now turning to AI to learn.
If I'm going to other countries also, I would gladly still use AI to learn at the end of the day.
In Lagos, Nigeria's commercial hub, the city is home to a rich mix of local and international languages and cultures. Now something is changing. I'm on my way to meet Google West Africa spokesperson Taiwo Kola Ogunlade to learn more about the company's latest trends report.
From the data, personally, the one that surprised me the most is AI and sign language. It's really, really mind-blowing and very interesting, right? Because I've been Nigerian for all my life, over 40-something years. And sign language isn't something that you hear most people talk about.
He says language learning is no longer just about communication. It's about opportunity, work, and global connection.
Some of the most brilliant people that you would ever meet are people who don't speak your language. And you have to learn to speak new languages. It expands your world, and it will take you to places where you never would go. There are economic opportunities as well. People who do businesses with people from different parts of the world are some of the fastest growing regions economically, or some of the most advanced regions technologically, are regions that don't speak what we speak. China, for instance.
For many young Nigerians, learning a new language no longer begins in a classroom. It begins with a prompt.
Mac Warchi Okafor reporting from Lagos. Christopher Nolan's blockbuster adaptation of Homer's epic The Odyssey has made nearly $270 million on its opening weekend. But the tale isn't just winning over film fans. Interest in the book itself is booming, with copies flying off the shelves, as Lizo Mazimba reports.
No one could stand between me and home, not even the gods.
The Odyssey is proving to be a hit in the bookshops as well as at the box office. Many fans of all ages have been inspired to go back to Homer's epic poem, with sales of print editions rising by 700% in the UK compared with the same period in 2025. In the past week alone, almost 8,000 print copies were sold, taking the total so far this year to 47,000. And it's not just been physical book sales. An audio version, read by Sir Stephen Fry, is on the Spotify UK audiobook top 10, while a narration by Sir Ian McKellen has entered the equivalent chart in the United States.
Lizo Mazimba. Well, one person who is not a fan of the film version is Elon Musk. He has strongly criticised what he calls woke casting. On Wednesday, the South African-born billionaire posted on X that he was using his AI tool Grok to create, quote, a historically accurate movie. He even suggested he might be willing to give controversial director Mel Gibson $100 million to make it. But what are the challenges of creating an authentic version of Odysseus's journey home from the Trojan War? Dr. Emma Greensmith is Associate Professor of Classical Languages and Literature at St. John's College, Oxford. She spoke to James Kumarasamy.
The story of Homer's Odyssey is set in the legendary aftermath of the Trojan War, which is conventionally placed to be around the late 13th or early 12th century BC, so during the late Bronze Age. But the other history at play, which is when the Odyssey was probably composed, is much later, so around the late 8th or early 7th century BC, the Iron Age. And what we actually get in the Odyssey is a blend of Bronze Age material and customs, weapons, social practices, more from Homer's own time. So the very premise of making a historically accurate Odyssey, I would be interested to know, it seems to me to be they would want to do both, but that bothness would be a real challenge.
Its origins are in an epic poem, but in an oral one that might have been sung to music, is that correct?
That's exactly right. So before becoming fixed written texts, as we would understand them, the Iliad and the Odyssey belonged to an oral performance tradition. So the early performers were called aioidoi, so literally singers, or rhapsodes, so literally stitches of song. And they would deliver the verse in a meter called hexameter. in kind of a melodic or a chant-like way, probably accompanied by an early type of lyre called a phorminx.
It should be a musical then, really.
Yeah, a musical in some ways, but not in the modern sense. First of all, it would be just by one person. So the ioidos or the rhapsode would be a singular performer. There were loads of them in the 8th century, these sort of travelling singer poets, but they would do the whole of the story on their own. So no parts, no casting, probably no dance and no costumes.
Dr. Emma Greensmith talking to James Kumarasamy. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Joe McCartney and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editors, Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.